Hello, this is The Link Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com in channel Problem Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
And we're back.
It's The Linux Show for, geez, what is it? It's November 25th, 2003. Late November week, a few days before Thanksgiving 2003, doing our weekly edition of The Linux Show. We have most of the crew here tonight. We're going to be without Russ, however. Russ is tied up, and hopefully he will be joining us within the next week or two. But we'll go ahead and carry on with the show without him. We've got the rest of the panel online tonight. And, well, how are you doing tonight, Doc?
I'm doing all right. Doing all right. Just trying to, you know, make the most of a short week, like the rest of us, I guess.
Yeah.
And need to clean out my office. I have a construction on two sides of the house of my office, which is a standalone building, and I realize that the dust is so thick on everything, I can't even see what color the surfaces are. So I think I need to clear this place out and really give it a going over. So that's how trivial my life is right now.
Yeah, you need one of those electrostatic dust gadgets from Sharper Image.
Yeah,
suckers actually work.
Yeah, I'm told that. I'm tempted to get something like that.
Expensive as hell, but they really do work.
Yeah, because it's really bad. There's probably two or three pounds of dust scattered all over the entire room here, and it's just. You know, when you've got a bunch of big screen windows, this is what happens.
Of course, how hard can those things really be to build?
The hard problem is the high voltage. They run about 5,000 volts or so.
Hmm.
And the high voltage power supply is what's expensive because you have to have some pretty hefty capacitors to be able to do the voltage doubling.
What do they do? They just
it's basically they take and. They put a voltage across a bunch of wires and then a grid, and basically it forms a hideously large electrical field which tends to filter out the ions.
Yeah, it basically dust takes on, I guess, a negative charge in the air, and this thing has metal plates in it that take on a positive charge and, you know, magnets. Plus
actually,
plus.
I got a solid-state Tesla coil around here. I built many years ago.
There you go.
10,000 volts.
There you go.
There you go.
You could light up the world with that, eh?
Well, a very small part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, so you'd stand on top of that and hold a piece of wood in the air and it catches fire, right?
No, actually, it's so little current, you can actually have it arc to your finger. It doesn't hurt. Looks really cool, though.
I'll bet. So how are you, Ernie?
Oh, everything's fine. It's been a very busy day, and I just got home a few minutes ago, and then I had to run off for an errand the last second, so I'm just basically catching my breath.
So is your school on quarters or semesters?
Semesters, and we don't end until January.
You see, I just ended today.
Oh, well, we just ended a quarter, but we're you know, that was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so I spent last night and today on that last-minute mad dash, getting all the grades done. That always sucks.
Grades aren't too bad for me. Basically, it's just an auto-magic thing. Just the computer tells me what the grade is, and that's the one I give them.
Yeah, well, it's really funny. Today is the last day of the quarter, and I was getting calls on the phone till like 11:30 last night from students asking me questions on their take-home final.
Oh, my students know better than to have a take-home exam. They know that it would hurt them badly.
Yeah, well, I like take-home finals. It makes them suffer.
Yeah, they're brutal, all right.
Yep. So, and how are you doing, Kevin?
Oh, not too bad.
Things going well at Fermi?
Oh, yeah. Trying to figure out what to replace right at 9 with, but other than that, things are going pretty well.
Yeah, it keeps on staying in the news locally, though, about all this terrorist crap and security concerns out at the lab. But nothing exciting seems to be happening.
You work at Fermi, Kevin?
Yep.
All right.
Yes. Yeah, a little bit of trivia is that Kevin works at what is perhaps one of the cleverest uses of government money in the history of the United States. Now, government is notoriously bad at spending money. I should say they're good at spending money, but they're also good at wasting money. But Fermi Laboratories is really an amazing idea in that they budget, you know, these massive billions of dollars for Fermi to buy billions of dollars worth of really unbelievably cool tools and computers and all kinds of gadgetry, and then they invite all of the most brilliant young people from around the world to come play with these billions of dollars worth of tools. And so basically our government can keep an eye on some of the most brilliant physicists in the world because they figure it's cheaper bringing them to places like Argonne and Fermi than it is letting them stay in their own countries developing nuclear weapons. So, you know, science benefits from Fermi, and it keeps the world a little bit more peaceful. So every once in a while, our government, I suppose, does something right. And Fermi Laboratories is one of those great stories of something that actually worked in government. So
the Tevatron rules.
Yeah.
Were you putting
back
in
online now?
Giant clusters there?
Oh, yeah. We got several farms. There are a couple hundred Linux nodes.
Yeah, there was a... I was just talking today to... did an interview with Enrico Pesatori, who I knew when he ran Zenith Data Systems in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. I used to go there. Not from where, far from where you guys are.
Oh, cool.
And he now is the new CEO of Penguin Computing. Sam Ockman and his guys hired him there. He came from Digital and many other places. Good guy. Been around a long time, and Penguin's focusing on almost entirely on the high-end clustering business, which is quite huge. Something like 45 out of the top 50 supercomputers today are Linux. I mean, they're just big piles of Linux boxes. And I'm sure Fermi's in there somewhere.
Yeah, Fermi's got a couple rooms full of Linux clusters. So that's pretty remarkable, you know. Like seeing stuff like that. It sort of gives me a kick.
When I was at Argonne in the 70s, they were quite into nuclear energy. And, of course, that's probably changed.
Yeah, Argonne gets redirected all the time.
Well, I mean, they hold a big, huge repository of plutonium there.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, there's a lot.
Security is very tight.
There's a lot of weapons research that goes on there, but Fermi is pure science.
I don't think this Department of Energy.
Yeah, but Arnie, there is weapons research going on.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
No, Argonne is the reason why Chicago is on the top five list of potential nuclear targets.
Yeah,
it's because of Argonne Laboratories. It'd be an ideal target to hit because it would spread all that plutonium all over the place.
There you go.
So, but anyways, on to more pleasant subjects than being at ground zero of a nuclear war. Let's go ahead and jump on to the first segment of the Link Show tonight and talk about the general news. And, Doc, the first story on the list of the show tonight is your long-awaited story on, or at least it's part one, and part one of your... story on Linux Lunacy.
Yeah, well, there are actually six items that are going up, and I think there's only one left to go. There's a three-part report that ran last week on the cruise itself, and that covers like two or three-day segments. And then starting yesterday and then continuing today is the long and I have to tell you, extremely complete, considering the fact that I sat there and transcribed every word of it myself, in spite of noise in the room and the rest of it, of Linus giving his annual State of the Kernel talk. I think Jeff Bates Hemos had slashed, I probably would have slash dotted it today had it been, had our servers been up to it. We had some server problems.
You still are. And by the way, I meant to say that.
It's still going on. We're still trying to figure it out. We don't know what it is.
For people not to go immediately jumping onto the Linux Journal website, because you're just going to...
It's a real bummer. It's a real bummer. I don't know what, we're figuring it out. We don't know what it is. It's some problem. It's our servers are with Phil Hughes, our publisher in Costa Rica. That's where they are. That's not an issue. It shouldn't be an issue. It's just their same servers we've used for years, I guess, but it's just some problem. We don't know what it is. But anyway, our best minds are on the case, let me put it that way. In any case, I hate to say it was kind of slashdot not to point at it today, but it's good stuff, and there are a lot of there's a lengthy description by Linus of Sparse, which is a utility that he wrote to help with kernel development. It's over my head, but I did transcribe it, and I did take pictures of his slides describing it, and his his putting up on the wall code and other things. It was pretty cool. You get a sense of, what a kind of relaxing and good time we had there with that. So if you want to see what the state of the kernel was as of 2 months ago, it's a pretty good place to go, and it's probably not a whole lot different than it is right now. Very interesting stuff in there about what Linus is looking for in maintainers as people move up the sort of caste system that's there.
So what is he looking for maintainers?
A combination of, I should go there and look at it again, a combination of technical chops, what he calls good taste, and a reluctance to flame, which is a hard thing to find. It's hard to find a set of those three characteristics together. And obviously, people who contribute good code to it. He says there's still an 80-20 rule for accepted patches and other contributions, but there are in the long tail of other people contributing to it. There's a slide there I'm looking for here. It actually just came up pretty fast this time. Well, it's taken a while for it to come down, for the pictures to show up, so that's part of it. But basically he's saying that there are some really good people that are sort of back in the pack right now that I think he's looking toward taking over. Andrew Morton has become his right-hand man, more or less taking over for Alan Cox. There's a slide there that has more about people. Parallel development. There were 12,479 changes in 2003 as of September, an average of 9 per day. Top 10% of the developers did 78% of the changes. But he said the important is the tail, the long tail, is all the future developers that he sees. One of the interesting things that I found that from him, and not only the talk that he gave, but offline, later, and also from Ted, is that a lot of what Microsoft thinks about what Linux is about, which is big companies being involved in it, is not really true. That it's not, the actual development of Linux does not appear to be, driven a great deal by the IBM guys, or the HP guys, or the Red Hat guys. That especially in respect to those big companies, they're not even putting, one gets the sense when talking to the people that work there that they're glad to have the job, but it's not top priority for the company. It's not that the top of IBM says we're going to use Linux to wump on Microsoft and here's how we're going to do it. It doesn't work like that. Rather they're paying people to work on the kernel, and they'd rather they work on stuff that's interesting to IBM than that's not interesting to IBM, but that's about as far as it goes.
Well, sure, but that's really logical. Ted Fry has never hidden the fact that although IBM contributes, the main emphasis of the developers is going to be developing things that aren't there within Linux that will help IBM sell iron.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's their mission-critical function as a company is to sell iron.
Yeah.
And not necessarily to work on the kernel. The kernel just happens to be a byproduct that work that they do contribute on, we get the benefit of.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good symbiotic relationship, for like you said, for Microsoft and or in the case of Go, to say that Linux couldn't have gotten there without the contributions of the big corporation really does not give credit to an extremely talented pool.
Yeah, and the whole notion that I've heard from some Microsoft people that there's a, you know, that their enemies are running Linux is just not the case. You know, they may have a kind of an enemy with Linux, but it's not the way they're characterizing it, or at least these guys have characterized it to me.
It's also, when Microsoft says this flies in the face of the reality of how IBM came to Linux.
Right. Yeah.
IBM has always looked at the operating system of their hardware is something that just goes with the hardware.
Right.
You know, like the System 360 and all, System 370, all those. I mean, it was basically, people would pay for maintenance, but they wouldn't pay, they'd buy the hardware and it'd come with the, since it was so all proprietary. Now with Linux, they can leverage their developers who are already working on Linux.
Yeah.
And who are, had Linux all over the labs.
Yeah.
And basically they said, well, we already have it. Why don't we just embrace it and use it? And it's been a real boon for them.
Yeah.
Sold a lot of hardware.
It's interesting, if you go to the piece, which if you go to the Linux Journal site, it seems to be coming up fairly well right now. So if you go to the Linux Journal site and look at Linux and the Lunatics Part 1, one of the things he says is high visibility and lots of work, but apparently hard to get official company support. What he's talking about there is basically it's hard to get, he may have it from IBM and some other companies like that, but for the people who are important to kernel development, it's not necessarily easy to get that support. What he said is he's looking for is he says it is very hard to find people who don't flame and are calm and rational and have good taste. I mean, it's like, give me one honest man. It doesn't happen too much, and at the same time, when it happens, it matters a lot. Just a few of those people can make a huge difference. Alan Cox used to be the main one to some degree. He's gone off to do an MBA. Don't ask me why. So that's so there, it's, you know, the point that he's making there is that that people are still the biggest reason that Linux happens, and it's not necessarily about companies. It's really about just good people. And
companies are there. Well, someone in the chat room is asking about universities' involvement, and I imagine that's pretty heavy too.
I imagine it is. He didn't bring it up. That doesn't mean it's not happening. It's just not that it's again, thousands of people contribute to the kernel. So
yeah, I think more in the university you'd see more computer science programs contributing than computer
right.
business programs, because computer business programs are pretty much owned by Microsoft.
Right. One of the things that I heard from a guy who'd be fun to have on a show sometime, Doug Kay, K-A-Y-E, who I saw both at ApacheCon and earlier at one of the ISP events that we both spoke at. But a point that he made was that if you go back in history over the last 30 years, 20, 30 years, you'll find that the vendors really ran things to the degree, especially in education, that Digital, for example, and Data General would give machines to universities or sell machines at a discount to universities. So a lot of computer science types were were weaned on PDP 9s, 10s, and 11s, and then VAX systems. And then Apple did a very good job of seeding the universities and schools with desktops. And then IBM and Microsoft did a very good job. And he said, now none of those guys can compete because cheap PCs are so easy to get, and all these guys are doing Linux. So it used to be that the vendors were really running what was happening in the universities. That's just not the case anymore. That if you're in a university and you're involved in computer science at all, you've got, you know, regardless of whatever laptop you may be running, for example, you're going to be having some interaction with Linux on your servers and on your own machines. You're just going to be doing stuff with Linux. And Linux is just becoming the lingua franca. And it's because the hardware is so cheap and easy to get.
Well, plus the fact that if you're studying operating systems, that's what you want.
Right, exactly. This is what you want. And that's what people are doing right now. And now there is I don't know if did any of you guys see the Bill Joy interview in Wired?
I saw a bit of it.
It was, I'm going to have to confront Chris Anderson on the cover. It says Bill Joy on why Linux sucks and other subjects. And he didn't come out and say, he didn't say Linux sucks. What he said was, I'm trying to find it here. I have a big pile of magazines here. But what he said was that, you know, he made a dig about Linux being derivative. Well, what do you expect from the author of BSD, right? You know, I mean, it's, you know, the prime or original author of BSD. And he had some very kind things to say about OS X. But then he went on to say that he's got a cluster of 10 Linux boxes doing cool shit in his house. So where's that at? Is that because they suck? You know, I don't know. Anyway, I just had to say that. So I can't find it. It's a big stack of magazines here, but it's the current Wired. And just the fact that they would have a headline that says why Linux sucks tells you how big Linux really is at this point. You know, Linux is the overdog at this point in science today. It's just totally the overdog.
In science, yes.
Yeah, in science. And that's where I've been today, talking to Enrico and some other people, you know, that it's really huge in science. It's huge in politics. As a matter of fact, I have to get this out for anybody in the IRC or anybody who's at all close to this. I sent you a note about it, Jeff. We're trying to cover this. It's a big story I'm working on right now, is how Linux is being used by the political parties and by the candidates in this electoral season. And it's really huge on the Democratic side. And I think the main reason for that is because you've got a bunch of different candidates. I mean, it's the race is over on the
There's
Republican
nine
side.
Candidates.
You got nine candidates. You got an awful lot of people that need to be cheap and resourceful. And of course, what's going to happen, right? They're going to have a lot of Linux stuff. And as hackers come in, they're going to be running Linux. It's okay. But I need some Republicans. I need some guys. I need some conservatives. Libertarians, I know. I got you. You're covered. But that's and I'm in sympathy with libertarians, and I consider myself one. But
I don't see Linux as a political thing. Because
no,
I think both sides.
It's not about politics. It's
no,
I,
not
I
about politics.
I need some balance here. I need some guys that'll tell. I had a guy write to me. He says, because I ran this little piece. It's the shortest piece I ever wrote in my life, and it got slashdotted. It was on the Linux Journal site where I just went to Netcraft and I looked at what everybody's web servers are running on. And it was kind of interesting because most of them were PSD or Linux, but the Republican National Committee, the RNC, was running on Windows, and they were rebooting every 2 days. And the Democrats were running on Linux, and they hadn't rebooted in like about a year and a half or something.
Yeah, but the White House runs on Linux.
But then I heard from a Republican guy saying, "Hey, look, I consult the Republicans, or consult the White House, and as a matter of fact, that with the Bush campaign, the website is Windows, but everything else is Linux." I said, "Well, great. Tell me more." And I never heard from the guy again.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I told him and post something on the site where there were like 160 posts that splashed over from Slashdot. Nothing. So I'm sending out an appeal to people here. I need some guys on the Republican side that are doing some hacking. You don't have to tell me exactly I don't, it's not for quoting or something. If you're a little bit scared, or you know, but just let me talk to me. You know.
You know, I think you'll find that across the board, this is you know, both sides are using Linux
right,
in a big way.
But yeah, but I can't write it unless I get somebody, some Republicans
yeah.
in here. I just can't.
That's right. And but you know, like you could pull Congress offices, congressional offices. See what they're using.
Yeah, well, I've already got Doc lined up a couple of people.
Yeah, give me some people. I need some people. So that's. So anyway, go read the Linus of the Lunatics thing. It's a fun read, and it's an interesting take on what's been going on with the kernel lately.
Okay. Anything else tonight, Doc?
I've said too much. So.
No. You never say too much.
No, yeah, that, I guess the only other thing is just that I had a really great time at ApacheCon, and it was very interesting to see the difference in the development modalities between Linux and Apache, where Linux is clearly run by Linus, and Apache is clearly very organic, and as a matter of fact, that's where Brian worked for a company called Organic, Brian Bellendorf, who's probably the prime mover behind it, but he's, you know, he will disclaim being anything like a Linus here. He doesn't want that job. Nobody wants that job. The way that patches are accepted and they're voted on is kind of an interesting process where they're vetoed. Anybody gets a veto right, but then they have to justify it, is how I understand it. Maybe somebody else can correct me on that, but it's a very organic process, and I had a very interesting time, and I gave the closing keynote there, and And I showed on screen on my slides different magazines and newspapers and TV networks, and asked where people got their news. And a surprising amount got it from Linux Journal. I was very impressed. But for the most part, none of the major IT magazines, Computer World, eWeek, InfoWorld, nobody reads them. None of those guys read them. But they're all sitting there blogging, okay? I counted like 30 blogs coming up from the audience while I was there. They're all talking to each other. They're all using a zero-conf rendezvous to do live IM with each other. Really interesting shit. And so, I mean, I'm what I'm looking at right now, and it's very interesting to me, is I want to, whatever our next publication is going to be, is going to start on the web and is going to aggregate what people are putting in blogs and in similar publications. I don't want to limit describing it to blogs, because a lot of people are running things that isn't blogware, but they do have RSS feeds, and that's one of the a lot. RSS was a very big topic there, which stands for Rich Site Summary or Real Simple Syndication. Mark Pilgrim gave a talk on Atom, which is a new metadata format. But basically, what's happening now is that any one of us can, as soon as we publish something on the web, if an RSS or a similar kind of notification goes out, other people can listen to it like a radio signal and know immediately that something's been said. This allows anybody to syndicate anything to the entire world. It's a major value add to the web itself and to the net itself, and it changes publishing utterly. It changes politics. But that's a big part of what's going on right now with the campaigns. As soon as somebody says something, it's known. That's a, you know, you're not just, you know, when you publish something on the web now, it's not snow on the water. It can be heard. And that's pretty interesting stuff.
That's another aspect of it. Those candidates that seem to be doing fairly well, Dean, for instance, seems to have the most together internet policy.
Well,
I mean, he's fairly open. And
he's got a together internet policy. But the interesting thing is, as we were had a little talk up at the O'Reilly, people put together a little event to talk about what's going on in politics right now. We're probably going to have an add a track to Emerging Tech next spring, the Emerging Tech Conference, to talk about this stuff. But one of the guys there described Howard Dean as a hood ornament on a movement. That's not about Howard Dean.
Yeah, it could be.
You know, just because the antlers are in front of the car does not mean, you know, that there wasn't a deer that got caught by this car coming through. I mean, Howard Dean has been adopted by people, and he's had the smarts to be in, you know, it's very much like Linux. I mean, it's like he's the IBM. I mean, IBM is in compliance with its engineers. That's how IBM got behind Linux. It's the same kind of thing, you know. I mean, Howard Dean got in high compliance with a lot of stuff that was happening in the electorate in real time. And I mean, there are thousands and thousands of posts. They make Slashdot look small, frankly, on the Dean Blog for America site. All they did was turned on the comments feature of Movable Type, which is one of the relatively open source systems that are being used for blogware these days. And there are people writing on there that they think they're blogging. I mean, and they read each other, and there's no way you or I or normal human beings can sit there and stand and read through all this shit. I mean,
it's like Slashdot. Who can stand?
It's exactly like Slashdot without the moderation or anything, and yet the sense of participation is huge. These people are sending in money.
Well, you just said the operative word. It's participation.
It's participation.
It's impossible for the electorate to go to the Dean site and read all the comments that are posted there, just like it's impossible for us to go to Slashdot and keep up with what's going on Slashdot.
Yeah, I mean, who wants to go to Slashdot and set, you know, their mod viewer level at zero or something?
Yeah, but that's not, you see, the whole point is participation.
Right, but that's the point.
That's
it is participation.
It's participation. It's buying into the process. And that's something new that, you know, and again, frankly, you know, Dean has caught on to this, but the parties as a whole have not yet caught on to this.
No, they haven't.
The parties themselves are still stuck in the top-down organizational model. They're not into the internet bottom-up organizational model. Dean's candidacy is a fairly unique thing.
If you want to hear it, this is worth going to. There's an absolutely outstanding interview with a guy. I don't know him. His name is Sterling Newberry. If you look up Christopher Lydon, Lydon, look up Christopher Lydon, and who's a Berkman fellow at Harvard who used to be an NPR host of a program called Connections in Boston. Now he just does interviews on his own and he puts them up on his blog. And his interview with Sterling Newberry, who ran the draft, one of the draft Wesley Clark sites. This guy nails so many things. I mean, I recorded the interview and I played it like five or six times. I mean, the guy, I don't mean to stroke myself here, but I mean, he quotes Cloutrain a number of times. But he takes it and he runs with it. And one of the things that he pointed out about how top-down politics has failed is, in fact, with the Clark campaign. There was this terrific draft Clark campaign that was based entirely on Clark's own writing. I mean, Clark wrote a book or two coming out of the Kosovo War. That had I haven't followed it, but he had a vision for America, and it was something that turned a lot of people on. And as soon as he declared for president, he basically, you know, hired some Clinton people. Clinton kind of anointed him as his favorite candidate without saying so directly, and they squeezed out and ignored these people that had already been doing the grassroots work, people like this Sterling Newberry, and it's a very interesting account, because
the draft Clark movement was doing a similar thing to what the Dean movement was doing, too.
And the truth is, if Clark had come along, and, I mean, let's face it, Clark is, on paper, a much better candidate than Dean. You know, he's a general, a successful general. I mean, he's got some marks against him here and there, but for the most part, he's a very, very presentable candidate. And he's a centrist. I mean, he was apparently a Republican at one for a period of time. But there was this huge loss of momentum. But anyway, one of the things Sterling Newberry talks about is what he calls open source politics. I mean, all these guys are exposed now. You know, we can look at what they're doing. You know, we can look at what they're doing and how they're doing it, and critique them and get behind them or not get behind them and help them out. I mean, I know so many people that are helping out with the Dean campaign and the Clark campaign. Cameron Barrett is now one of those good guys. He's one of the original bloggers. I mean, he goes back a lot farther than I ever did, like 1997 or something. He used to work for Brian Bellendorf at CollabNet. has, you know, great Linux/open source credentials, and he's running the Clark campaign blog right now and making up for a lot of that lost ground. And they've created entirely with open source materials and tools, blogs that let anybody who supports Clark come on and blog without any interference, hosted by the Clark site, by the Clark people. So, I mean, they kind of learned their lesson there. It's really an interesting thing to watch. So politics is a really interesting topic right now.
Yep, certainly is. And I imagine as the months go on, we're going to be talking more and more about it. So, Arnie, have you got some stories for us tonight?
I got a huge number of stories tonight.
Well,
I'm going to go through them as fast as I can because people can read them. They're interesting. I had two at press time that dovetail really nicely, and I think I'm going to cover these first. There's two stories. One is in one I got to by November, a couple of weeks ago. SD Software Development Times had this, and I see another copy. So there it is. Wind River reverses its course on Linux, and apparently this article has been syndicated. Actually, it's written by a different guy, so it's in different, same title, but EE Times ran a same titled article, Wind River Reverse Direction Launches Linux Tools, and the link should be up on the website there. This is about Wind River, which is an embedded market thing, whose main product has been BSDOS, which is they target on the embedded market, I believe. I think their deal.
The VxWorks is their.
Yeah,
they were huge in the embedded. They were the Microsoft embedded. Really.
They've imported that particular product to Linux, mm-hmm. and they've recently gone through a new CEO at the beginning of the month, and apparently this direction started back in the article is dated October 3rd, and so this movement was coming for some time, as you would expect. But at the beginning of the month, they've announced, or beginning of the month, last month, they announced that they're reversing their direction. They were saying Linux isn't very good on the embedded market, and they have completely reversed their direction and are into adopting Linux big time and putting their major tool set to that. Now, dovetailing with that is another article about Oracle. And this is on the Computer Business Review Online. That link should be on the website. And this is Oracle developers switch allegiance to Linux. And here they talk about Oracle developers are saying, wait a minute, Oracle on the other platforms just ain't making it. Linux is the way to do it. And this is strong, strong, strong. You know, the software development part of this business is really what drives everything. It's bottom up again, and in order to get the tools adopted by large corporations, there has to be software available. And when software developers are moving, we always knew that Linux was a developer's system. But when software developers start, you know, changing direction, moving to Linux when they, you know, had previously not, when you see all these developers coming into the Linux fold, we know that things are really, really gathering some steam. And these two articles really, really portray that picture very well.
Yeah, however, for good or for bad, there's two edges to the real wholesale shift of commercial tools starting to become available for Linux.
Yeah,
that's really good, but people need to be aware of the fact that if commercial tools are now going to start to be used for the development of software, that does change some of the things that we have been used to in the past in terms of, you know, people using basically GNU tools or derivatives of GNU tools. Once you have commercial tools being used to develop applications, Not everything is going to be subject to the GPL anymore.
That's right. That's what I was. That's you're exactly right.
It's going to launch a new era for Linux in terms of being a below the sea level platform for applications running above the operating system, just like what's going on in Windows right now.
But see, it's going to take that kind of movement to build Linux to the huge extent which we always have thought it would was capable.
I agree, and it's actually an inevitability. Linux is such a logical choice for any kind of development house because you've got a universal kernel that you can use on a wide variety of platforms. It's, you know, one source code, one set of tools, whether you're using GNU-based tools or commercial tools, you still have the luxury of using one set of tools. It's extremely cost-effective for a software development house.
And then for Oracle, for instance, Oracle, you can use a variety of tools to go into Oracle, from using the GNU compiler to link in and to the SDK or whatever, you know, or you can use something proprietary. I mean, there's a huge spectrum of capability there, and I imagine the embedded market is the same way. Well, we know that's true.
Yeah, well, the embedded market's going to be a unique case because with the embedded market, you're always going to be nailing directly into the kernel. At least I'm presuming such.
Well, to some extent, Zorus has some SDK stuff, and
yeah,
you know,
yeah. But I am presuming that. I'm sure there's ways that they can come up with of putting some kind of an API layer between the operating system and software. But embedded is unique, a little bit different from other kinds of
stuff. Yeah, it's because you're so close to the hardware.
That's right. That's right.
And a lot of real-time stuff happening there, too.
Yeah.
An important thing to consider is the fact that with Wind River endorsing Linux, that makes Linux victory in the embedded space is pretty much complete.
It's over. Yeah, it's
over. It's so over at that point.
Well, we knew that. We suspected that when Toshiba and Fujitsu and all the Japanese companies came on board a few months ago and said, "Okay, we're forming this new consortium that's who's dedicated to bring Linux to the embedded market."
Yeah.
We knew that already.
Just bear in mind, and I think this maybe was just one as well, that that we're going to see Linux used to deliver DRM for Sony. That's going to happen.
Digital rights management. Thank you.
Yeah,
very little.
Yeah.
Well, as long as the SDKs and the APIs are open, you know, go ahead.
But isn't that ironic?
Yeah, it is ironic, but it's going to happen.
Make DRM open source, and then we'll be...
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple other really interesting articles. LinuxWorld.com is publishing an article from George Stakos, KDE core developer, who says that Microsoft is afraid. And he's commenting on their recent experiences at Comdex. And that's a short article. You might want to... He was getting a lot of visitors from Redmond, I guess, at the KDE booth, and he's drawing some of his conclusions on that, based on that. ZDNet is publishing an account of the Debian Linux site hack, and recent news, the latest links on that story, claim Debian is saying that none of the source code was affected, as we probably knew that it was pretty safe. They keep that pretty much behind the firewalls. So there was no degradation of the source code on the hack.
I would hope there would be a backup copy of it somewhere anyway.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's plenty of mirrors at Debian. There's an opinion piece. Novell open source software champion, Ron Anderson, Network Computing. This is a... That article has been recently been retitled. When I printed it, it now says, "Legal squabbles over Linux demonstrated strategic significance, but do business no favors," says Simon Morse. And so there's a new title to that one, very long-winded. basically he's saying that the Novell purchase is a good thing for Novell, and basically what we've been saying for all along. Here's a great one.
I think we've been saying maybe good.
I think Novell's in big enough trouble that Linux can help it.
Yeah.
Here's a really good article. This is a technical article in O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Network, Linux Dev Center, called Using and Customizing NOPIX. And this is a really great article. And those of you who are interested in NOPIX or using NOPIX, this is an in-depth how-to on how to get a custom NOPIX up and running. And it goes into quite a bit of, it's 3 pages long on the web page, and they're pretty in-depth pages with, screenshots and stuff to help you along. I didn't read the whole thing, but it looks pretty good from what I saw. And that's a good article. Let's see, one more. Major vendors push Linux to the desktop from InfoWorld.
That's one of my stories this week too. I think that's a.
Why don't you go ahead, Jeff?
We can both comment on it. Interesting thing about this, a lot of people are talking in terms of the press conference that actually launched the story that you're referencing.
Mm-hmm.
Is some major backpedaling, some major efforts that has gone on within the corporate offices of Red Hat to counteract the bad publicity that they experienced 2 weeks ago because of the ZD story that talked about Red Hat bailing out of the desktop business.
Yeah, more puffed up headlines from ZDNet.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of interesting talk going on about how much of this is real and how much of this is just backpedaling out of refer back to the original quotes from Mark from Red Hat, and he really was very clear. If you really drill through his original comments, that Red Hat is in no way giving up on Linux on the desktop. They see their future as the enterprise desktop, and perhaps that was a signal to the rest of the market that they were relinquishing the consumer market space, but no way was Red Hat saying that they were giving up on Linux and the desktop. This is not the truth. ZD made it sound that way, but it's just not the case. And so Red Hat has really made a lot of effort the last couple of weeks to get other companies rallying around the enterprise desktop to convince everybody that they are committed to their product. And
they've made some moves in the commercial field to punctuate that.
Yep.
Because what's happened here, and the way I see it, is that basically with ZDNF is puffed up the article with the usual let's promote the controversy here and see if we can get things stirred up just to get the click throughs, and then of course Red Hat has to come back and clarify what they really meant. And I agree, it's they really aren't giving up on the desktop. It is a enterprise, though.
Yep.
Something that's worth saying here is that when I talked to Enrico Pezzatori at Penguin Computing this afternoon, he said, I mean, if I could paraphrase what he said, basically, as a market strategy at their end by going after the high end, if you've got fish to shoot in a barrel, that doesn't mean you're not fishing for other fish, So in their case, when you've got biotech firms, for example, buying Linux units to cluster by the thousand, you're going to sell those, and that's a pretty easy market to go after. Whereas trying to, be Sisyphus and pushing the same Linux on a desktop rock up the same hill that nobody's managed to push it up for the last 6 years doesn't mean nobody's going to push it. It just means that nobody's going to take the lead on pushing it right now. But it's going to happen. Nobody doubts it's going to happen.
Yep.
What's interesting is, and I haven't linked to them, but there's been quite a few stories in the last few, 2-3 weeks maybe, about Star Office and Star Office being adopted quite widespread. And there's some people, some very prominent companies saying that the Star Office is a much better thing and much preferable to the Office upgrade spiral. You know, and it's a lot more stable.
Yeah, and you know, some companies are going after it. Star Office has gotten some bad reviews too, you know, from people who want it to be just like Office. But at some point, good enough is good enough.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah, and there are an awful lot of circumstances where good enough, you know, is not, you know, the entire Office suite as, you know, as we've come to understand, it's bloated itself.
Yeah, well, let's just look at this from the simple vantage point of your typical executive within a corporation. If Office 97 or Office 2000 is suiting the needs of your clerical personnel just fine, and the cost of upgrading your clerical personnel to Office 2003, which is going to require an automatic upgrade to Windows 2000 or Windows XP, that kind of an upgrade, if you're within the Fortune 2000 size company, is going to be significant. That expense is going to be the difference between whether your annual corporate junket is in the Caribbean or your annual corporate junction is in French Lick, Indiana.
Yeah.
And these are real simple bean counter kind of decisions that are being made now on the enterprise when they're saying enough is enough.
Well, I mean, plus the fact when you're upgrading the operating system, you're usually upgrading your hardware too.
Well,
there's also support costs to consider, and that is that can go both ways.
Yep.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, it can.
Take it, Jeff.
Pardon?
Take it, Jeff. I'm done.
You're done?
Yep, that's it. That's all stories I had.
It is 52 after the hour. We're already 20 minutes beyond our normal break time. Kevin, why don't you put on a real short tune? We're going to take a very, very, very short break. And then we'll come back with segment number two. Segment number two is not going to be very long tonight, so we should have taken our break a little earlier. But we're going to come back with our segment number two story, which is titled Lies, Lies, and More Lies. Also subtitled, I Am the Walrus, Goo 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 Tube, and sort of a special little announcement that I'm going to be making tonight about some information about SCO that we haven't talked much about SCO tonight, but this one could not be passed up. I'm sorry, I just could not resist this. So we'll come back after a short break in segment number two and talk about delusions over at SCO. So everybody hang in there, kick back, relax, listen to the tune. We'll be back in about 2 or 3 minutes.
And we're back.
And this is segment number two of the Linux Show for November the 25th, 2003. Got a little tongue-tied there. Segment number two is going to be a little bit different than usual. It's going to be fairly short. I'm going to tell you a little story, and then I'm going to ask our listeners to do us a little favor. I think what I'll do is I'll ask you to do us a little favor in advance, and then I'll tell you my story as to why I want you to do what we want you to do. Well, first of all, to plug the Linux Journal, because the Linux Journal is 50% of the motivation for doing this. Prior to me heading out west to Vegas last week, I was looking for some really short and concise bits of information that I could use during the couple of panels that I was going to be on at the various expos to respond to questions from the crowd, in particular pro-show type of comments. And Don Marty had published a little piece in it was sort of an open letter to from Don Marty to Jack Powers, the guy who was the conference director of Enterprise IT Week, which basically was a list of about half a dozen lies by Darryl McBride. But rather than just stating the lie, Don did something that was very appropriate from a journalist's point of view, and that was to provide commentary and source as to why it was a lie. In other words, he was not only countering, but providing the evidence as to the counter. So what we'd really like to do is to develop something like that in a very large way. And that's where we get to the second part of the motivation of what I'm asking people to do is take a look at the Linux Show website tonight. You will see a link to the Grok Law quote page. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Grok Law quote page. They've built themselves a little database that is accessible by the quotee, so you can go to a list of people's names and click on it, and it'll bring up a list of the various quotes that are listed there from them. Doc, there's quite a few quotes from you there listed there. And it's wonderful information. However, it's just quotes. Quotes of them of themselves are not evidence of lying unless you present information to show that that quote is a falsehood or an outright lie. And so what I really want to do is I want to get people motivated to take a little time. And if people within the Linux community will help out on something like this, the folks at Grok Law can certainly push ahead on expanding what they've already done with their quote list and make it not only a quote list but a reference resource to why these attributable quotes are indeed lies. This is going to be immensely helpful to our friends at the Security Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice sometime in the near future when they put the folks, the executives of SCO on the stand for securities fraud, which I am quite confident will be happening sometime in the relatively near future, a year or two out. But we'll see. It's something that indeed will have to be proven. Now, why? Why am I asking you to all go out to Grok Law, look at a quote, and then research it? You know, I want you all to throw a half an hour or an hour into researching one of these quotes and send in information why it is a lie. Why am I asking you to do this? Well, it's simple. It's because I am the walrus. And what I mean by that is y'all probably heard the press conference, or at least a quote from the press conference held last Tuesday night by Darryl McBride of SCO, in which Darryl claimed that SCO was getting death threats, or the executives of SCO were getting death threats. I'd like to give you a little bit of history as to what actually transpired that afternoon, and also a little bit of history of prior background information. A detailed explanation of all of this will be going up on the Linux and Main website either sometime tonight or tomorrow. I'm sure it'll be picked up by Linux Today. Just keep an eye out for the Linux and Main website or Linux Today for a link to that story within the next 24 hours. The article is going to be entitled Darrell's Lies and Delusions. The focus of this is on SCO and their efforts over the last 3 months to convince the public at large that people within the Linux community were absolute loonies and dangerous. And during the course of the time frame leading up to the SCO Forum conference, rumors began to circulate that somebody was going to do something to Darrell McBride at SCO Forum. And sure enough, when I showed up to SCO Forum, a number of people who were attendees of the forum walked up to me and said, "Hey, there's been rumors going around that you," and that's referencing me, Jeff Gerhardt, "that you were going to do something like throw a pie in the face of Darrell McBride when he gave his keynote address." Now, personally, I think that was a great idea. I wish I had thought of it myself, but I didn't, and that was the first I had heard of the rumor. Later that night, I was approached by a couple of the PR people from SCO, and they walked up to me and said, "Hey, Jeff, we hear that you're thinking about doing something tomorrow at Darrell's opening address that we think would be very unadvisable for you to do." And I said to them, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you referencing?" And they really wouldn't get specific, but they just said, "We don't think whatever you've got planned you ought to follow through with." Later on that evening, a couple hours later, I got approached by a senior executive within the company from SCO who bodily threatened me. He basically told me that if I attempted to do anything to Darrell, he was going to beat the crap out of me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Okay. Now, I'm not going to give this guy's name. I do not have a witness, that, unfortunately, that overheard that comment. I do have witnesses that did overhear the comments from the SCO conference attendees and from the PR people. They happen to have been other journalists who were attending. So I do have witnesses that I can corroborate this information with. And then the following day when the SCO Forum actually began, Darrell's opening comments, here I am sitting in the front row of the SCO Forum, Darrell standing there looking at me, telling the audience that they have heard rumors that somebody sitting in the audience is going to attempt to do something, and that over on the corner of the stage is one of the executives of SCO who used to play football at Brigham Young University and was an All-American, and will beat the crap out of this person if they attempt to do that. I knew they were talking to me because they had accused me of the same comments the night before. So that's just the general attitude that SCO has had about me for some reason. I have no clue why they think this. Well, I have some opinions as to why I think they're saying things like this about me. I think they're trying to discredit me. But I think this is one of those cases where if you say lies about people enough times, you begin to believe the lies yourself. You know what I mean?
I think, but they never said it was Jeff Gerhardt, did they?
They never came out and said my name.
Yeah, well,
other than when they were talking to me.
They're trying to discredit the movement by portraying a situation which they've conjured in their brain.
Exactly, exactly. I think it's a case of they say things so often they end up believing it themselves, or they want so badly to believe it that they believe it themselves. But now let's leap forward into the future. We're now at the Enterprise IT Week Expo. It is approximately 75 minutes prior to the Darrell McBride keynote address, And
key
I,
not address.
Well, whatever. And I, of course, am on the panel that's immediately following. I had promised the people in the sound booth that I would be there about 10 minutes ahead of time to make sure I got fitted for microphones and stuff like that. Anybody who's done one of these things at a conference knows the routine. You've got to do sound checks ahead of time. But anyways, I stuck my head in the door of the keynote room approximately 1 hour before they were going to start letting the people in. And standing in the middle of the room were a whole bunch of people from SCO. And Darryl was getting set up to do a practice run-through of his speech. And, I thought it was sort of rude for me to stand there listening to him practice. So I just smiled, waved, and ducked my head out. About 3 minutes later, the security guard came charging out the door. And the people who listen to the show will remember me commenting about this on the show. This was prior to any knowledge I had of the press conference, the SCO press conference, okay? So the guy from SCO comes charging out, starts screaming at the people who worked for Enterprise Week and the people who worked for the building, demanding that he talk to people from security because a known security threat was seen looking in the keynote room. That person was me. Nobody else, me. No one had walked down the hall. So, in other words, that's pretty much SCO telling the management of the expo that I'm a danger. And sure enough, 1 hour later, or 2 hours later, more likely, Darryl, in his emergency press conference, mentions that he has gotten a death threat. Now, to clarify this further, I have no doubt that sometime during the course of the last 3 months, last year, that some sophomoric idiot from the Linux community might possibly have sent Darryl an email saying, "Oh, I could just kill you." That kind of stuff happens with immature sophomore people. Whether you can actually interpret that as a death threat or not is questionable. It's sort of like those use of language issues that you have to look at, like when you're watching a football game. "Oh, I could just, kill the umpire. I could kill the coach, strangle the coach for what he's done to my beloved football team." Things like that. I think these are just utter delusions on the part of some people at SCO. Plain and simple, these death threats don't exist. And for the others at SCO, I think this is an extremely nasty, directed attempt to make the entire open source community look like criminals. During the panel last Tuesday night, those of you who are listening to the panel heard out of Chris Sontag's mouth, he basically called the entire Linux community a bunch of bank robbers. They've now escalated that rhetoric that we're not just bank robbers, we're now potential murderers. This is now starting to get into the area of slander. And that's really why I felt it was necessary for me to comment, because this is really getting over the edge. This is getting to be a significantly dangerous talk, and that's why I'm hoping that the people within the Linux community, those listeners to the show, will spend a little effort. Participate a little bit. Rather than just listening to the show, spend a little effort on going to GrokLaw and picking up one of these quotes and doing a little research. Take an hour of your life and write up a short, concise, and 100% factual rebuttal to a quote that is made by either Darryl McBride or Chris Sontag.
or basically cite a web document which does rebut it.
That would be fine, too. As long as everything is thoroughly attributed and factual. No opinions. Opinions are a waste of time. It has to be fact-based. But I'm really trying to, I'm hoping that enough of you will start to get motivated that we can take that list of half a dozen that was originally on the Linux Journal website a week ago, and that perhaps over the course of the next month, month and a half, we can have a list of several dozen attributable outright lies that have been stated by Darryl McBride and Chris Sontag. It's about time that the evidentiary list build. I know for a fact that there's lots of people out there that have already started this process, and hopefully some of them will step forward and throw the work they've already done on top of the pile and getting it moving along quickly. We will see what happens in the future. But that's it. I just wanted everybody to know. Again, keep an eye out for the Linux in Maine website, because there will be a complete detailed write-up of the events of the last week, and my source of why I believe what I believe, and hopefully you'll enjoy the reading as well. It's been an interesting 3 months, that's for damn sure. But if there's nothing else, I know Doc has already signed off, but if there's nothing else from Arnie or Kevin, are there, guys, anything else you need to discuss this evening?
Well, I think Daryl and Chris Snotrag are being a little bit immature and childish, and they're certainly not acting like responsible, you know, major officers of a major corporation. They're acting like kindergartners.
Arnie, I think they've become reckless.
Yeah, I think it's reckless, and I think what they're doing is they've become desperate, because things aren't going well in the legal end of it, and so they're trying to puff this thing up, you know, by making, you know, they're making brash statements that, you know, just don't hold up. They just don't hold up in the pure white light of day. And, you know, your threat, I mean, you know, hey, Jeff, if you're a threat as a journalist, I mean, you're probably a threat as a journalist to them, but not physically a threat.
Oh, well, there's no question that I am a threat to them. I have publicly stated that I am out to get them from the standpoint that I want to see them go away. I want to see their company, you know, blow away into the wind. You know, I think we'd all be better off if it happened.
Well, I mean, but that's mainly because of their actions, and not their actions, and not because you don't wish any personal ill will on their people. You wish personal ill will on their actions.
That's correct.
And you know, in the pure white light of day, everything they're saying is a bunch of trash. And the lies are going to come out. And they're going to, you know, we need to send that to the Wall Street Journal, maybe, huh?
Well, hopefully. Because one of the things that I made it a goal last week during that panel to say as many times as possible that I have evidence from the Open Source Initiative that totally refutes Sko's arguments. And I said that 3 times during that panel, that same couple of sentences.
Yeah.
And I think if enough people start saying those same couple of sentences over and over and over and over again, pretty soon people in the mainstream media are going to say, oh, really? Can you show me that evidence? And in time, that's going to happen. It's going to happen. Now that IBM has started to move really seriously move forward on their case, I'm sure that they want as many people as possible to see the results of the OSI study. The normal schedule for the Linux show is we're a little spotty in December. We generally only do two, maybe three shows during the entire month. We do try and sneak a show in between Christmas and New Year's up show. But keep an eye on our website, www.thelinuxshow.com, for an announcement on the schedule of the entire month. We really need to poll everybody on the staff here and find out who's going to be in town, out of town, what weeks. It's a busy time for all of us and our families, and we will attempt to have as many shows as we can. But there's always complications in the month of December, so do keep in touch with the information posted on the website. So until next week, which will be the first week of December, till then, this has been the Linux Show for November 25th, 2003. We hope to see you all next week. We're out of here.
And she is the sea, and she bleeds. From every dawn to every dusk of every day. If she is the boat and he is the breath that fills the gale. The crest and fall and thrust and throb of the long sail. If he is the sext and she is the stars by which he guides. From suffering sea to port at every even tide. If she is the gull and he is the sanguine song she cries. A wistful wordless question pulls the sea and sky. If he is the house and calm and she's a summer storm. That drowns him in her furious skin, the hungry, wild, and warm. Ripples in the deep blue, quiet places of our hearts. Tumbling in the deep blue, quiet places of our hearts. Every ocean has its depths that we could never hope to chart. It is here that we have anchored every secret of our hearts. If he is the stream and she is the tale, his babbling tones. The dream of every desert, every empty well. If she is the cliffs and he is the waves that shatter here. Steal away the stone and hopes of creeping near. True unity is impossible, we understand. But this doesn't stop the sea and shore from being.